Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. It's nice to be with you again. I'm happy to welcome Dr. Andreas Wesele to enlighten us about the disagreements between Slavs and non-Slavs in Eastern Europe. You know that he has been my guest before. This is a subject that goes to the heart of many problems we are still experiencing. I'm going to be asking him everything that I ever wanted to know within the time that we have. So, hello, Dr. Wesele, and welcome.
Thank you very much. As some of you might know, I was born in Prague, Bohemia, and so I do know quite a bit about the relations between the Slavs themselves and the Slavs and the non-Slavs and Slavs and the Germans and Czechoslovakia and the United States and various other topics.
Let me just start out by saying that when I looked up the Pan-Slav Congress of 1848 that took place in Prague, which was in the Kingdom of Bohemia at the time, it's represented as being organized against what they called increasing German nationalism. Yet German, they say, was a primary language used by the participants. So please by telling us what this Congress was really all about.
It appears that the program of these extreme Pan-Slavists in 1848, who drew a line starting from the Western Baltic in Lübeck down past Bamberg and Regensburg and Salzburg, all of which would be on the Slavic side of the question, and down to Trieste, everything east of that line, especially those who were German or Hungarian, would have to be gotten rid of, say, kicked out or possibly, you know,
killed, even
exterminated or expelled. And that was in 1848. And at least part of that really became very influential then after 1900. This Pan-Slavic ideology became pretty powerful even before the First World War. And the interesting thing is that in the 18th century, this Pan-Slavism originated with a number of Slovak Lutheran ministers. Mm-hmm. Because a minority of Slovaks is Lutheran, possibly those who are either directly descended from Germans, of, you know, 5 or 7 or 8 centuries ago, or who were influenced by the Lutheran confession. But anyway, so in the 18th century, one of those gentlemen, his name was Kollar, K-O-L-L-A-R, which might be derived from the German Kolle. Anyway, he was a Lutheran. He studied at the University of Jena, J-E-N-A, in central Germany, which is very close to Weimar, where Goethe and Schiller and Herder and Wieland and all those other greats, and later on Liszt, did much of their work. Anyway, so the gentleman named Kollar studied at the Lutheran University in Jena, and before that, apparently, he had already done some research collecting what he thought were Slavic folk songs and so on, and he sang some of those to Goethe, the great German poet, and then he finally wrote a book called Slavicera, which means the daughter of Slava, and Slava being the protective goddess of all the Slavs. He took the position that all Slavs really spoke one language, one different dialect, which of course isn't true at all. Anyway, then he and the various other people worked at this Pan-Slavic ideology, and of course was supported in the course of time by the Great Russians. The Great Russians means the Muscovites, the rulers of Great Russia, who saw in that a chance to speed up and to increase their expansionism into Central Europe and into Southeastern Europe, especially Serbia and Bulgaria and all those places, which at the beginning of the 19th century still belonged to the Ottoman Empire.
Oh, well, somebody was trying to tell me that it was Russia who defeated the Turks in the Ottoman Empire. It wasn't the Austrian-Hungarian, but there was a battle that was decisive somewhere around Vienna. Wasn't that the Battle of Vienna? But this person was trying to, you know, was very pro-Russian and was telling me, oh, the Austrians and Hungarians couldn't defeat the Turks in 600 years or something like that, you know, all these times. But then when the Russians got into it, they got in there and they drove, and, you know, they did so much damage that it weakened the Turks, and then the Austrian-Hungarians were able to beat them only because Russia had weakened them so much.
Yeah, well, that's not true. Well, there are many things that could be said about that, but the main factor, the main reason why the Ottoman Empire really weakened was internal conflict and internal corruption. They were very corrupt. And,
well, there you go. Isn't it always that? It's always the internal, internal that destroys a civilization.
With the Roman Empire, you know.
Mm-hmm. Kind of outer enemies.
Right. Seems to be the same thing now with the United States, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But, well, Austria carried on. And Poland. The Poles also defeated the Turks sometimes. Because originally the Ottoman Empire was still strong. They pushed across all of northern Hungary, now Slovakia, all the way to the Vistula River in southern Poland. And they made their horses drink from the Vistula River, meaning that they wanted to occupy all of Poland. But they never got to it because they're internal contradictions, because of their degradation and corruption, and also because they had to fight against the Persian Empire in the east. So the Turks not just fought us, but they also fought the Persian Empire in the east, and various other people, the Mongols around 1400, Timurling, and all that jazz. So it's a rather complicated thing.
Well, at this point, let me ask you about the Polish Empire, or whatever it was called at that time. You know, I have a little bit of bias against the Poles. I know it. But I want to be fair, and I want to know the truth. So this kingdom that they had back then, what would you say about it? Were they strong? Were they a good nation? Did they deserve the reputation they give themselves? And what kind of a place was it?
In my eyes, so-called Polish-Lithuanian Empire, which arose in 1386 when the Grand Duke of Lithuania, which at that time was a great empire in Eastern Europe, married the Princess Hedwig or Jadwiga of Poland, and he became Polish king in 1386. And that was primarily a Lithuanian empire, because the Lithuanians had conquered much of what today is White Russia, Belarus, and the Ukraine.
Well, what kind of people are the Lithuanians?
Lithuanians, together with the Latvians, belong to the old Prussians. The old Prussians, not the Prussians, mm-hmm. but the old Prussians who lived in what today is East Prussia, belong to the Baltic branch of the Indo-European languages. And they speak languages that are related to Germanic and Armenian and Slavic, Old Greek and all that stuff, you know.
So the non-Slavic Lithuanians were the stronger part of that Polish kingdom.
Right.
But it's always called the Kingdom of Poland, or did the Kingdom of Poland come later?
It's called the Jagiellonian Empire because
I've heard that.
Grand Duke of Lithuania, yeah. His name was Jagiello, which means Jamie. It comes from Jacob, Jacob meaning James. And so Jagiello is Jimmy Carter.
That's that university, isn't it? That's what's that that famous Polish university is named?
Yeah. Krakow.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But that's actually not quite true, because before Jagiello, there was a great Polish king named Kazimir the Great, and he reigned in the 15th century, and he really did found the University of Krakow.
So, well, what about that Jagiellonian University? That's what University of Krakow is now?
Right. When Jagiello came to power, then he strengthened and supported that university.
Okay.
But another thing that should be said is that Krakow at that time had a very strong German component. There were very rich German merchants who were there.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they built practically all of the old city of Krakow.
That's right. That's right. I'm aware of that. That's another thing that kind of irks me, because like Prague, that's really a German city, and everything that was done there
exactly.
was done by Germans.
Exactly. And great German artists like Veit Stoss.
So great.
Yeah, they went to Krakow because they were being paid, you know, by the Polish king and so on. And they mm-hmm. became well-known artists in Krakow. Mm-hmm. But they were not Poles, they were obviously Germans.
Yes.
Yeah. So all these things, of course, the Poles are Catholic, which usually sets them up against the Russians or Eastern Orthodox. And then around 1600, old Ivan the Terrible of Moscow, who tried to expand in the western direction and so on, was defeated by a Polish king. It was actually Hungarian from Transylvania.
Well, here we go again. See, now this Polish king is actually a Hungarian. Now,
that's right.
This is why I'm asking just how great were the Poles in their kingdoms that they say they used to have theirs, why they deserve all that, and why that's their place and their land, and they were invaded by other people who took it away from them this time and that time and the other time, and yet so much of what was ever done there, the people who did it, the great names and so on, are not actually Polish.
That's exactly true. And then later on there came some Swedish kings who also became kings of Poland.
Even Pilsudski was a Lithuanian. Yeah, I mean, yes, he identified as Polish. Yes, he was born there, I guess, but his parents were Lithuanian immigrants or something like that.
Yeah, Pilsudski was born in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania.
Okay, he was even born there. All right.
Yeah, and so then after 1920, the Poles annexed a big chunk of Lithuania, including Vilnius, because they thought it was Polish, you know.
Yeah.
And then... At the same time, they invaded Soviet Russia together with a hetman, one of the chiefs of the Cossacks, along the Dnieper. And they hoped to increase their power or their empire eastwards up to the Volga River or God knows where. But they didn't make it. And then they were driven back. And then there was a so-called miracle on the Vistula, which happened because Stalin, who was the commissar of the southern wing of the Bolshevik army, made a mistake, and this allowed Pilsudski and some of his Polish officers to launch a counterattack with French support. This was all supported by the French. And then by the Treaty of Riga in 1921, the Poles got a comparatively huge empire in the east, which included a big chunk of the Ukraine, Belarus, and Lithuania, and part of German Silesia.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, also the so-called corridor west of Danzig. So they mm-hmm. got all of that with French support. And then Woodrow Wilson was also kind of biased in their favor, or generally biased in favor of the Slavs, because he wanted to have a counterweight, so-called counterweight, with the Slavs on one hand against the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of pan-Slavism, well, that's a lot of things you could say. But at the end of the First World War, around in October and November of 1918 and then 1919, with the so-called Peace Conference of Paris, the Czechs had some really wild pan-Slavic plans, or at least the leading Czechs, like Masaryk and Benesch and a few others. First of all, they wanted to establish a so-called another Slavic corridor through the Burgenland. As I said, the Burgenland is the border strip between Hungary and Austria, and they want to push south from Slovakia through the Burgenland south until it hit Croatia or Yugoslavia, in other words. So there would be a Slavic corridor in a population that was primarily German with a few Croats. And then, right. So they would have the Hungarians in a cauldron, you know, in the middle. And the Hungarians would, in the course of time, all be either driven out or killed or made into Slavs.
Why did they always hate Hungarians? Because they weren't Slavic and they didn't want to be
That's
Slavic?
That's right, they were not Slavic. And the Hungarians were, they were the dominant people in Southeastern Europe, north of the southern branch of the Danube River. You know, you have to look at the map.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And actually, the Hungarians then in the 11th century penetrated down to the Mediterranean. They took Croatia and Dalmatia. So from the 11th century until 1919, Croatia and Dalmatia were part of the Kingdom of Hungary.
Yes, let's take a little moment here for you to explain. Tell me what you think of the Hungarians and why they have become, they are now such a minor country with, not so minor, but they have a lot of troubles. And yet I think they're quite a good people. Give me your opinion on all of that, or your, it's not just your opinion, but what you know about it.
Well, the Hungarians have done a lot of very intelligent things, and they've contributed a lot to Western civilization, or what's sometimes called Occidental civilization, but primarily under German and under Italian influence, Italian especially through the Pope in Rome, also through Byzantium and Constantinople. But, of course, as Byzantium became weaker and weaker as the centuries went by, the German and the Italian influence grew very strong in Hungary. Anyway, the date at which they conquered what today is Hungary and Slovakia and Transylvania, which at that time, of course, was all Hungary, was 893 to 895, around that time, A.D., so rather late, after the Avars, who conquered pretty much the same area before them, and before them the Huns. So maybe some of the surviving Huns who possibly remained in parts of Hungary then merged with these Hungarians who came in from Central Asia. But the Hungarians were originally basically a confederation of Finno-Ugric tribes. They're related to the Finns and to the Estonians and to the Ugric tribes along the Ural Mountains. The Ural Mountains, mm-hmm. and even east of the Ural Mountains in Siberia. But at the same time, they also apparently were joined by Scythian tribes, blonde, blue-eyed Iranian peoples from around the area of the Caspian Sea, and it's a great mixture, and possibly one of these, the tribe, the Magyar, became the leading tribe of the Hungarians, even while they were still wandering around in what today is Russia, and the Hungarian is partly, maybe to 51% Finno-Ugric, including very complicated grammar, but they're also very strong Indo-European influences.
And which part is the Magyar? Is that the Indo-European or is that the Finno-Ugric?
Yeah, they might have been. They might have been. You know, these things are pretty murky at the moment. But the Magyar, the name Magyar might have been or might be related to the Persian name Magi or the Magi. The three Magi here went to Bethlehem to give, or to, not to worship, but to give gifts to the king of the Jews, Jesus, and all that stuff. One of them might have been Hungarian. Of course, we should say Proto-Hungarian. Magi, Magus, meant those priests and magicians of the old Persian religion.
Wow. Well, how would you describe the Czechs?
It's very hard to say, like, the Czechs, because there was no such thing as all the Czechs having the same ideology. Even in 1914, at the beginning of the First World War, the majority of the Czechs, the Czech people, the middle class and the peasants and so on, wanted to stay with Austria. It was only with the defeat in 1918 and the various consequences that came from Panslavism in the 19th century, that they began to think about their own country. Well, and anyway, then these intellectual Czechs like Masaryk and Beneš and a few others had these weird plans. Even though Masaryk spoke about the Switzerland of Central Europe, he officially, openly, he talked about Switzerland, then Czechoslovakia might become like the Switzerland of Central Europe. But unfortunately, he probably didn't mean it, because at least some of his associates, like Beneš, who was also a university lecturer, were even then, in 1918, thinking about expelling the Germans and the Hungarians, which then, of course, was taken into hand in 1944 and 45, a few decades
later. Yes, yeah. Okay, so that's another point. Besides the thrust into the West, was this desire going way back to expel all the what they considered they didn't want, which was the Germans and the Hungarians, mainly.
Right.
But maybe a few others, too. Now, where was Romania in all of this?
Well, the Romanians used to be called Wallachs or Wallachs, which, again, is a Germanic word related to the word Welsh or Walsh and so on, which denoted Celtic people.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the Wallachs originally were Celtic inhabitants in part of Transylvania. But anyway, the Romanians claimed to be descended from the Romans, because Roman Emperor Trajan, around the year A.D., a few decades after Emperor Augustus, Trajan was a very powerful general, and he expanded the Roman Empire in the east by conquering Dacia, or Dacia, which encompasses what today is Romania and part of Hungary, and he also conquered Iraq.
The Romanians that I see, and I don't see that many, but I mean in pictures and stuff, so many of them, they're very dark. They have dark around their eyes. And this is a gypsy look, though. So are these really gypsies that I'm looking at?
Gypsy Romanians? Gypsies. There are a lot of gypsies in Romania, and they're very
Indian look.
The real Romanians, the gypsies, or as they like to be called, Roma.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the gypsies came from India and Pakistan.
Yes.
And even now you have millions of gypsies in India and Pakistan, or used to have anyway, migrating from village to village and singing and dancing and putting on minstrel shows and all that kind of stuff for the people. And this has gone on for the past, 5,000 years or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of these gypsies then migrated out of India, including Pakistan at that time, west, into Persia in the at the end of the Middle Ages, and then apparently the Turkish invasions from Central Asia into Asia Minor and into Egypt, then pulled his gypsies along with him, and they continued being musicians and magicians and even lesser, shall we say, less desirable occupations. And they went along with the Islamic and with the Turkish conquest of the Near East and of Southeastern Europe. So they went into Spain, and they also went into Greece, Macedonia, Serbia, Hungary, and what today is Romania or Wallachia.
We have to take a news break now, Dr. Westerly. We'll be right back, so don't go away, listeners.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
$38 billion have been poured into Afghanistan by the U.S. since the 2001 invasion to bolster security and economic development. A significant chunk of that money, humanitarian aid to provide food, build health clinics, schools, in one of the poorest countries in the world. All part of the U.S. effort to win over hearts and minds and to convince Afghans to reject the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Drop off some humanitarian aid supplies as much as we can. It gives the people the knowing that we are out here, we are the good guys.
But there is a dark cloud looming over the battle for hearts and minds. It's known as America's black hole in Afghanistan, a secretive place journalists and human rights activists still depict as a liability to America's so-called war on terror. Former detainees have described the Bagram detention facility as the scene of heinous crimes, a place into which people simply disappeared without a trace. Two detainees were tortured to death by U.S. forces in 2002. While the scandal exposed the use of torture to obtain information from detainees, today, Bagram, renamed Parwan Detention Facility, rarely makes the news.
Bagram is still very much a black hole. It's a prison facility that is operating that we don't have very much information about. There are about 600 or so detainees that are there, many of them captured outside of Afghanistan.
Although a list of names were released last year, a federal court recently denied access to any other information pertaining to those detainees. Global outrage and condemnation over detainee abuses in America's notorious Guantanamo Bay prison forced the U.S. to change its practices there. But those languishing within the walls of Bagram were less lucky.
The detention facility at Guantanamo Bay is thus the most transparent wartime facility in history.
Bagram Detention Facility in Afghanistan, do they have the same standards for the litigation process?
Bagram is in a wartime theater. It's an active war zone. It would be unprecedented to have such access.
The original Bagram Detention Facility may have been renamed, relocated, but it will take more than a fresh coat of paint to ease the fear Afghans associate with the prison. Reports of a prison within a prison persist, with Afghan President Hamid Karzai recently demanding greater Afghan insight into the prison's affairs and greater legal recourse for its detainees.
Which is why human rights advocates insist the billions of dollars sent to Afghanistan does little to buffer and shine an image of America that has already been tarnished by places like Bagram.
A lot of the...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. My guest, Dr. Andreas Westerle, has been telling us about the origin of the Romanians, And also, who were the gypsies who call themselves Roma? Please continue, Dr. Westerly.
In the 14th and 15th and 16th centuries A.D., the gypsies became minority tribes in southeastern Europe and in Spain. And they're still there, still are there. But as far as the Romanians, I think the Romania has something like 51 or 31 different minorities, including the Hungarians and the Germans. The Romanians consider themselves descendants of the old Romans who colonized.
Yes. You think that's true?
Well, their language definitely is mainly Latin. It's related to Italian.
Okay.
But what the Hungarians claim that the Romanians actually lived in Dalmatia or Illyria along the Adriatic coast of the Roman Empire, and they only slowly migrated into what today is Romania in the course of time during the Middle Ages.
So they picked up the language, but they weren't Roman.
Well, a lot of them actually, ethnically or racially, are descended from tribes from Central Asia. Because many of these tribes, among them, of course, the Huns and the Avars and the Hungarians, etc., etc., many others, Polovtian, came in from Central Asia and they swept through the steppes of Russia, north of the Black Sea, and sort of got held up by the Carpathian Mountains. Then sort of filtered into what today is Romania. Carpathian Mountains, the eastern stretch of the Danube, and so on. So ethnically, they're probably related to all kinds of Turkic, not Turkish, but Turkic tribes and empires of Central Asia. But they were colonized by these Romanized settlers, who spoke a kind of a Latin language, which also includes a lot of Slavic elements.
And are the Romanians are considered Slavic today, aren't they? Isn't that considered?
No, they're not. Well, they consider themselves, and others, most of the others also consider them Latin, or at least speaking a Latin language.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So they're not part of that Slavic group either.
No, they're not, but they are Orthodox Christians, so they are more closely related to the Russians, you know.
Okay.
And Bulgarians and Serbs, who are also Orthodox.
You know, I'm sympathetic toward Romania because they never seem to be a problem from my perspective, but they don't seem to be very capable of getting their act together. I mean, is that because they're just made up of so many different odd things, or what? I mean, odd things.
Yes and no.
What's their problem?
the thing is that, say, in the 18th and 19th centuries, a phenomenon happened, which has happened again and again, that the more well-to-do people have fewer children. Okay, if you're, say, middle class or upper middle class or aristocracy, with some exceptions, you have fewer children. On the other hand, if you belong to the shepherds and the sheep herding communities, you have a lot of children, dozens and dozens per family. And, of course, a lot of them died,
okay.
But some survived.
Yeah.
So they kept expanding.
Yes.
And most of the Hungarians, most of the Germans, have fewer children in the 18th and 19th centuries, and the Romanians kept pushing into those kind of vacuum position, you know, expanding their situation ethnically.
Okay.
Valach, yeah. But then, of course, they also had this ideology dating from the 19th century and all that, which was not Pan-Slavic. But they said, okay, well, we've got people speaking Romanian that are now inhabiting Transylvania or parts of Transylvania. So all that has to be part of Romania, you know, and that's what they did. In 1915, they declared war on the Central Powers, on Austria, Hungary, and Germany, and at first they were terribly defeated, rather easily, but then, of course, when the Central Powers were defeated in October of 1918, then the Romanian leaders went through with their plan of having a great Romania, which would include all of Transylvania except for Debrecen, small part, which remained with Hungary. So after 1919, you have this huge Romanian state, which didn't exist before.
Yeah.
And it was also made into part of the so-called small Entente. You know, the Entente was originally alliance between Tsarist Russia and France at the end of the 19th century. But then, in starting with 1918, 1919, the French had the small Entente, E-N-T-E-N-T-E, which included Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Yugoslavia. And they were supposed to be the French shield in the East. Shielding, and then Poland also became part of it, but it was not part of the small Entente, but it was one of the great allies of France in 1919. This was supposed to be the shield, shielding France from German resurgence and from Russian expansionism. That's why Romania became so big. That was the main reason, actually.
I think you said in Poland after 1918, and that also Poland invaded Russia in 1920 with French help. I think, and then you said about 1.8 million Germans were caught up, and then by 1939 there were about 300,000 left.
Right.
What does that mean? And then you say also millions of Ukrainian, right, Russian, Lithuanians were subjugated and jailed by Poland. So what's that all about?
Well, it's about a Polish expansionism, a Polish imperialism, you know. And the Ukrainians point out that the Polish state at that time in 1919 was the first one outside of Bolshevik Russia to establish mass arrest, mass jailings, and concentration camps for the Ukrainians and the White Russians and the Lithuanians and the Germans and the Jews, which is never mentioned.
Okay, so Poland was doing this. See, I knew that they had they were very aggressive in going to war against their neighbors and winning some and accessing some of their land. But I didn't know that. Well, I knew that there was terrible stuff going on between Polish nationalists and Ukrainian nationalists. I've read about some of that.
That was very strong.
In fact, I wanted to write something about it, but I've never gotten around to it. But now you're telling me that once they did this, they were putting people in concentration camps and jailing, and were they also killing them or executing or what?
Oh, sure. That's right.
Oh.
They killed thousands and thousands. At the moment, it's hard to... We'd have to probably go to the Ukraine, Kiev, and those places to... research this question.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Why does nobody ever talk about this? This is something that's really swept under the rug, and Poland is just shown as a victim.
Right. That's, of course, totally untrue. Because very presciently and very craftily, the communist Poles in the 1950s, in 1960s, established a pact of understanding between Poland and Israel. So that was directed mainly against Germany, of course, and to some extent against the Ukraine and so on. And from then on, the Poles have had Jewish support and Jewish backing, and since the Zionists totally monopolized the public opinion in this country through all newspapers, all magazines, most of radio, certainly television in Hollywood, and they also monopolize Wall Street, they can easily paint Poland, which is now, since the 1950s, their friend and their buddy. Poland is being a really wonderful like a virgin that's been raped, you know, 200 times or something by his neighbors.
Oh, yeah.
But really totally untrue.
You know, Poland is painted by people who are anti-Zionist, let's say, as very anti-Jewish today.
That's
and
right,
they say, oh, they're just wonderful. They don't go along with the Jews. And yet they have all these agreements with Israel that you just mentioned. So how do you see that?
Well, it's purely political, you know. The thing is that before 1939, at least some of the Poles used to crucify Jews. I know personally from my childhood days in Prague, there were two little old ladies that lived across from us on the same street, and they came from a town named Sopot outside of Danzig. And apparently they had, of course, they were German Lutherans. Apparently they had some kind of a warehouse and some merchant activity. And so what happened was that before the outbreak of the European War, September 1st, 1939, which is definitely not the beginning of the Second World War, that's erroneous, but it's the outbreak of the European War in September 1st, a war between Germany and Poland, more correctly. These people in Sopot were actually for years and years terrorized by the Poles. And then with the last days before the outbreak of the war between Poland and Germany, all the men in this family were crucified by the Poles. They were nailed.
You mean actually crucified?
Crucified. They were nailed to the gates of the warehouse. The men, sons, fathers, all of them, all the men were crucified against the gate of the warehouse or whatever they had. And the ladies escaped, these two little old ladies.
Oh.
Yeah, well, and then they fled to Prague and lived across the street from us. And unfortunately, they lived above a Hussite prayer house. And in Czech, it's called Modlitevna, a prayer house. And then when the Czechs had their so-called revolt of May 4th or May 5th, 1945, by which time the war was really over, these poor old ladies who were around 83, 84 years old were defenestrated. They were thrown out the window.
Thrown out the window? That's what's called defenestrated?
Defenestrating is a very famous phrase as far as Czech history is concerned, because for one thing, in 1618, the 30 Years War started, which really included all of Central Europe, including Hungary even, by imperial emissaries, three men going up to the royal palace on the rocks overlooking the Moldau River in Prague, which is really incredibly beautiful. They went up there to confront the leaders of the Bohemian parliament. Can't really call it parliament, but Bohemian estates, the aristocrats of Bohemia, which were both Czech and German, but they were strongly Protestant. And they had elected a prince from the Rhineland, who was a Calvinist, as the king of Bohemia. And he was called the Winter King because he only reigned for about a year in Prague. But anyway, these imperial emissaries tried to talk to these Bohemian aristocrats, and they were then defenestrated, thrown out the window of this huge palace on the royal castle in Prague, down, and they were thrown out, maybe, possibly a distance of about 100 feet. They would have broken their necks, but they landed on a pile of dung. Yeah, they landed on the pile of dung, so they were, their honor was besmirched, but they lived to tell the tale, you know. And then defenestration was the beginning of the 30 Years War. Yeah, and then after that, 1620, There was the famous Battle of the White Hills outside of Prague, in which the Catholic forces led by the Catholic League, a generalissimo named Tilly, T-I-L-L-Y, totally defeated the Protestant forces, including the Calvinist King of Bohemia, who was German from the Rhineland, and he had to flee to England to his relative, King Charles I, I believe, at that time. So,
well, the way what, it went. And so what and about this 1.8 million things. Germans caught up, but by 1939 there were 300,000 left? Are you saying that this many were killed, or they were also expelled, or what?
Well, many were killed, and many were expelled. They were
Polish
mobs were threatened them with death, and they had to flee with nothing, just a clothes on their backs, and maybe a suitcase or something like that.
This is between, let's keep this clear, this is between 1918 and 1939, between the
exactly
two wars.
Exactly true.
After Poland
exactly
got
true.
Control of all that land, then
right.
they started, and this is what happened to the Germans. Out of
right.
Almost 2 million, only 300,000 were left there in Poland
exactly.
by
1939. That's exactly
and they
true.
Were persecuting the ones that were there.
That's right.
Oh,
and
hey.
A large part of that area, of course, some of these areas were settled both by Poles and by Germans, like around Posen.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are also the so-called water poles, Kashub. There are quite a few Kashubi here and on the south side of Milwaukee, you know.
I've heard that.
Yes,
sure.
Yes. One of them has become a well-known historian. It's a very interesting TV series about the history of Milwaukee. But anyway, these Kashubi were, to be sure, of Slavic descent, of Slavic speaking. Of course, ethnic, they were a mixture of German, Slavic, and Baltic peoples. You can't say they were Slavs. They spoke a Slavic language related to Czech and related to Polish. But most of these Kashubi and the so-called corridor, which was started by Woodrow Wilson, in which Poland was supposed to get access to the Baltic Sea, to Gdynia, or Gotenhafen, a port to the west of Danzig. And these Kashubi living there were actually, most of them were in favor of staying with Germany because they didn't want to be subjected to the terror and to the malfeasance and the chaos of a Polish state. Because Poland had no real bureaucracy, no state administration.
Ah.
That's right.
Well
and
put.
So
that's well
they,
put.
These Kashubi predominantly wanted to stay with the German neighbors, or remain part of Germany. But mm-hmm. they were not asked. But, you know, Woodrow Wilson and his friend Paderewski, the famous pianist and so on, who then became president of Poland, established his infamous corridor by which Poland gained access to the Baltic Sea. Yeah.
Now, and Paderewski also, was a piano player. He
right.
was a pianist. He was Woodrow Wilson's friend and advisor in this?
Friend, I would say. Yeah, he gave soirees. He played the piano at the White House. And Woodrow Wilson, being very easy to take in, but was taken in by Paderewski's piano playing, and he thought that, if we have this Polish corridor separating East Prussia from German Pomerania, then Germany will be made smaller and weaker, you know, and therefore we won't have to worry about Germany after 1919 or whatever, you know. That was his real plan. The main activity, actually, most of the time was commerce. Commerce, especially from cities like, or small empires like Venice and Genoa on the Mediterranean north into Germany, into France, and west into Spain and England and north into Scandinavia and Poland and the Hungarian kingdom and all that, a lot of commerce was going on and a lot of migrations, especially the German migration, as I tried to hint at, mainly since the 12th century, from Western Germany east as far as what today is Latvia and Estonia and Slovakia and Hungary and Transylvania and even Bulgaria. So all these migrations were going on for centuries, which were predominantly peaceful, you know, and they were supposed to aid commerce and lift the living standards of the people who were there to begin with, of the some of the Polish tribes and the Czechs and the Hungarians and the Slovaks and the people living in Transylvania and Bulgaria. These new migrants brought in new techniques and new money and especially new...
You mean the migration east, not migration
east, yeah,
west.
West to east.
What it is now. Yeah, west new, going into the east to bring help in
right.
Advantage.
New creativity.
Yeah, exactly.
And established humanistic high schools and colleges and universities, like the first German universities, as we all know, of course, was established in Prague in 1348 by Emperor Charles IV. Mm-hmm. And so many of these activities, and some of that also went on from, of course, from Italy, northeastwards into Hungary and Poland and so on. Much of this activity was actually cultural and commercial and societal. You know, it was not a great deal of conflict.
Why do they all gang up on the Germans? I mean, they've all got all their black spots in history, yet they all seem to go along, and I'm not saying it's a actual conspiracy. They just all, you know, see it's in their good interest to just blame the Germans for everything. And the Germans really have not been the ones doing as bad of things as most of the rest of them. Or am I wrong there?
No, you're right. The only trouble is, you know, that Germany was pretty much identified with the Holy Roman Empire for 1,006 years until 1806.
Okay.
So the Germans as such, or the German national character, received this kind of otherworldly, transcendental, you know, semi-religious or whatever caste. Religion or theology had a very strong influence on the German national character, which produced, of course, some of the greatest thinkers and philosophers and composers and so on of all time. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, this contributed towards making Germans less effective politically.
Isn't that the truth? Germans are too religious,
That's right, in a sense.
You know, they just find cover in that. They don't think clearly enough about what they need to do to survive as a nation.
That's right.
Exactly. Oh, that's so interesting.
Especially true now. And especially compared with the English, you know, because as I told you about a couple of years ago, I witnessed a strange procession in London with the Queen, and then the fly over the RAF, Royal Air Force.
Oh, yes.
And they included a heavy four-engine bomber, the Lancaster, which was the most fearsome British airplane in the Second World War, which probably contributed towards killing at least a million people in Europe. Here was the sweet old lady, you know, queen, who was really a bitch, but here she was blessing the Lancaster flying over, which had been one of the main genocidal tools of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we've covered a lot, and the next time we will talk about go up to 1939 and all of that. So goodbye for now.
Okay, goodbye, and say hi to Mike.
And thank you all for listening. Come back with us next week when Dr. Wesley will return to take us through the lead-up to what became World War II, including the devious activity of the man he calls Frankie Roosevelt. It's really going to get interesting. See you then.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.